Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Francis Alonso reporting. U.S. and Somali forces have attacked an al-Shabaab base west of Mogadishu. It's the second significant U.S. attack on the militant group in 5 days. A U.S. official confirmed to VOA that the raid Wednesday was a joint U.S.-Somali government operation targeting al-Shabaab. A local official in Somalia said helicopters dropped between 60 and 70 soldiers just after midnight. The official told VOA the troops then attacked 3 or 4 targets in the town, inflicting a number of casualties on the militants. The al-Shabaab said one of its fighters was killed in the raid. U.S. Vice President Joe Biden Wednesday condemned a string of attacks by Palestinians that came as he visited Israel. He spoke alongside Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. He called Tuesday's deadly stabbing of an American a heinous act. He called civilized leaders that could not see that the violence was appropriate behavior.
There can be no justification for this hateful violence. And the United States stands firmly behind Israel's right to defend itself, as we are defending ourselves at this moment as well. That's why we've done more to help bolster Israel's security than any other administration in history.
The United Nations Syria envoy, Stefan de Mistura, says substantive talks on a political transition in Syria are expected to begin on Monday and will not last beyond March 24th. He commented from Geneva on Wednesday as a second round of proximity talks between the Syrian government and the opposition formally opened, although several of the key players had not yet arrived. This is VOA News. Thousands of migrants from Syria and other countries are now stranded in Greece, blocked from their goal of reaching northern Europe after Macedonia closed its border Wednesday. Macedonian police closed the border a day after Slovenia, Croatia, and Serbia declared their borders closed to almost all transiting migrants, with exceptions being made only for asylum seekers. These actions effectively close the so-called Balkan route that many migrants have taken to reach wealthier nations in Western Europe. Iran says it has launched 2 ballistic test missiles Wednesday, purportedly inscribing them with a message in Hebrew that says Israel should be wiped from the pages of history. The semi-official Fars news agency showed pictures of it and said that it were the Qadr-H missiles being fired from Iran's eastern Alborz mountain range, and their target was 1,400 kilometers away off the coast into the Sea of Oman. The UN Special Investigator on Torture finds lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender people are at particular risk of torture and ill treatment, especially in places of detention. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA for the UN Human Rights Council in Geneva, where the investigators submitted his report.
UN Special Investigator Juan Mendes says there is a clear link between the criminalization of lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender relationships and the hate crimes, police abuse, violence, and stigma these groups face.
These categories of inmates are disproportionately subjected to torture and other treatment, both in penal and non-penal settings. There are at least 76 countries in the world that have laws criminalizing consensual same-sex relationships between adults, even in private.
Mendes says gender-based violence occurs in all regions of the world, in developing and developed countries. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Authorities in Afghanistan's southern province of Helmand say a group of at least 10 heavily armed Taliban fighters have staged a coordinated assault, triggering a gun battle with security forces. The attack early Wednesday in the Garish district targeted police headquarters and the offices of the Afghan spy agency. Millions of people across the Indonesian archipelago were treated to a rare total solar eclipse Wednesday. Sky watchers across 12 provinces and 3 time zones gathered as the moon began moving between the Earth and Sun shortly after dawn. A partial eclipse was also visible across other parts of Asia and Australia and out into the Pacific Ocean. More details on this and more at voanews.com. I'm Frances Alonso in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to African News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Ruhib coming up this hour on African News Tonight.
I would like to emphasize that it is very important for the country to gain clarity about the human rights violations that have taken place since the crisis started.
That's UN human rights investigator Pablo de Grief commenting on the situation in Burundi following an eight-day visit. Details coming up.
Also in the news, dozens of Ethiopian university students protested last night against recent police crackdowns in Addis Ababa. And in Nigeria, labor unions are protesting government plans to restructure the state-run oil industry.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on African News Tonight.
Our top story this hour: in Kenya, militant groups such as Al-Shabaab and the Islamic State continue to lure young Muslims to fight back. A local organization has launched a de-radicalization program to train imams and work with the affected youth. Lenny Ruvaga has the story from Pumwani outside the capital, Nairobi.
In Somalia, terrorists are killing Muslims. In Kenya, they seek to kill non-Muslims to create animosity between faiths.
Jihad, as we have seen in this clip, does not mean only, fighting.
Ramadan Aula takes two radicalized young men through a session. Today, the module is on counter-narratives. Aula is the program manager at BRAVE, short for Building Resilience Against Violent Extremism. Today's session has two participants who willingly signed up for the de-radicalization sessions. The program has reached 2,000 young people. For those trying to counter the message of radicals, such as clerics and imams, or youth not affiliated with a terror group, the program offers four-day training modules. For radicalized youth, those who have joined a militant group like Al-Shabaab, the program takes anywhere from 6 months to 3 years. In 2013, a United Nations report linked one of those officials at Riyadh Mosque in Pumwani to terrorist funding. Imam Izzedine Omar has been at the mosque for 5 years, and the BRAVE program trained him how to detect and counter extremist leanings in his community. Imam Omar says that before the radicalized youth accept to be de-radicalized, it takes a while and they have to go step by step. But eventually they succeed, even for those who are deeply rooted in radicalization. Abdul Mwangi is one of those youth who attended sermons in other mosques where radical preachers called on people to devote their lives to jihad. He shied away from that line of thought after going through the BRAVE program.
We were able to be told about the issue of the narratives. At least after there, alhamdulillah, what I can say, like for myself and my other youth, even if you tell me something that Quran says, yes, I will accept, but I will not do anything like doing implementation before I go back to the Quran and confirm for myself, or else I go to the Hadith or any other books that you might have been quoted.
BRAVE has trained about 150 clerics and imams like Omar, but the founder of the program says some are still staying away due to fear of reprisal.
Many Kenyans, particularly the Muslims, have been intimidated by the violent extremist groups to such an extent that they don't want to talk about violent extremism. They don't want to talk about terrorism. Now, this intimidation is so intense in places like Mandera in northeastern Kenya.
De-radicalization programs are not new. Saudi Arabia has run one since 2004. Both Nigeria and Mauritania have them. But there is a lot of debate as to whether they actually work. Experts like security analyst Andrew Franklin say root causes like unemployment must also be addressed.
De-radicalization programs are dealing with symptoms rather than causes of the problem. The real question is simply what causes people, youth particularly, to move from being alienated, marginalized and the like, to picking up weapons, in other words, becoming radicalized, to going off and to fight. to join terrorist groups or subversive groups, insurgent groups.
As prisons across Africa fill up with terrorist suspects, that is a question the continent cannot afford to dismiss. Lenny Rovaga for VOA News, Nairobi.
Dozens of Ethiopian university students protested last night against recent police crackdowns in the capital Addis Ababa. Reuters says demonstrators claim authorities have detained and beaten students during earlier demonstrations. The protests began in November over government plans to take over farmlands near the capital for urban development. Authorities scrapped the land reforms in January, but sporadic demonstrations have persisted. Ethiopia's Prime Minister Hailemariam Desalegn has promised to address grievances in the Oromia region that surrounds the capital. Mr. Desalegn blames rebel groups for stoking violence. New York-based Human Rights Watch said last month that some demonstrators were subjected to severe beatings and never appeared before a judge. Ethiopian authorities have dismissed the report. Rights groups and U.S.-based dissidents say as many as 200 people may have been killed in the capital city protests.
Police in Bujumbura have arrested one of the last opposition leaders remaining in troubled Burundi. According to the French news agency, family and supporters say 47-year-old Hugo Haramatachego, the president of the New Alliance for the Development of Burundi, was arrested at his home in the capital, Bujumbura, in a dawn raid today. Police were not available for comment or to describe any charges.
The United Nations Independent Investigation Team on Burundi says there are strong signs of human rights violations by both the government and the opposition since last April. That is, when protests against the incumbent president's run for a controversial third term started. Moses Havyarimana reports from Bujumbura.
United Nations independent experts spent 8 days in Burundi in the first phase of their investigation. They met, interviewed, and exchanged information with a wide range of actors that included the government, opposition leaders, civil society organizations, and victims of human rights violation. Mr. Pablo de Grief, who was part of the mission, said that the government officials were very open to engage. However, he says some individuals felt intimidated.
I would like to emphasize that it is very important for the country to gain clarity about the human rights violations that have taken place since the crisis started. So in addition to the fact that the victims have a right to truth, justice, reparation, and guarantees of non-recurrence, there is some danger involved in letting the issue of human rights undecided.
The United Nations Human Rights Council met last December and adopted the resolution to set up a mission to Burundi to look on ongoing and in recent past violations in the country. Since April last year, the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights reported well over 400 killings, more than 260 arbitrary arrests, and over 260 cases of torture or ill treatment. Christoph Haynes is the United Nations Special Rapporteur on Extrajudicial, Summary or Arbitrary Executions.
That the future of Burundi, internally in the country itself, but internationally, will depend on its performance in human rights. Human rights will be central to the future of Burundi. There are strong allegations of torture that takes place, of disappearances as well, and I think it will be crucial to address the situation and in a way to prevent future violations as well, to have ways of verifying the truth on the ground.
In the provisional report, the United Nations mission said that it is very important for Burundi to not only gain some understanding of the recent violations, but also address problems of impunity concerning violations that took place in the past. The second phase of the mission will include human rights observers. It is expected to be deployed later this year, with the final report expected in September. Moses Havyarimana, VOA Africa, Bujumbura.
15 minutes past the hour. This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. In Nigeria, labor unions today announced the national shutdown of Nigeria's state oil operations. They're protesting government plans to restructure the state-run industry. The French news agency quotes a spokesman for the Petroleum and Natural Gas Senior Staff Association as saying the move could worsen local fuel supplies. The government plans would break up the state oil and gas agency into 30 companies with individual managing directors.
And in Tunisia, authorities say they've killed two more terrorists in another clash in the town of Ben Gourdain near the Libyan border. AFP reports that brings the number of suspected Islamic State fighters killed in recent days to 45. Authorities say the militants were killed when they tried to break into a building to steal food. In related news, Italy's foreign minister says Islamic State has 5,000 fighters in Libya. He says the group has the ability to launch raids into neighboring countries. Italy, the U.S., Britain, and France reportedly are conducting reconnaissance and intelligence operations in Libya. Also, AFP reports Italy has given the U.S. permission to use an airbase in Sicily to launch drone strikes in Libya.
Meanwhile, the head of the UN support mission in Libya says the Islamic State group is taking advantage of the political and security vacuum in Libya. Martin Kobler told the UN Security Council that Islamic State is expanding in nearly all directions. Our senior Middle East reporter, Mohammed Elshenawi, explored different perspectives on countering the terrorist group in Libya.
Rival Libyan governments are still unable to agree on a unity government. The UN is reconvening a meeting this week to explore the way forward in line with the Libyan political agreement, which is crucial to start the campaign to uproot Islamic State from Libya. The UN deal calls for a presidential council to lead a unified government, with the current eastern-based House of Representatives as the main legislature and a state council as a second consultative chamber. The presidential council will name a new government in a month, and a UN Security Council resolution will endorse it. U.S. intelligence agencies say the number of Islamic State fighters in Iraq and Syria has dropped by several thousands. However, in Libya, their number has roughly doubled to about 6,500 fighters. U.S. members of Congress and intelligence officials spoke of their growing concern about the militant organization's expansion in Libya. Islamic State leaders in Syria are telling new recruits to remain in Libya, where the group established a stronghold in the coastal city of Sirte. Intelligence officials say the organization's immediate goal is to carve out a new caliphate in Libya. Martin Kobler, the head of the UN support mission in Libya, told the Security Council that the Islamic State expansion in Libya poses a regional threat in the African continent.
It's very important to limit the expansion of the Islamic State, because this adds to the difficult situation. They are expanding at this stage to the east, to the west, but also to the south. They have bridgeheads in the south, and in Niger and Chad in the south, the neighbors, there are terrorist organizations, and if they team up with them, it will be very difficult to redress.
The latest wave of terrorist attacks emanating from Libya forced Tunisia to seal the border. The U.S. hopes for defeating the Islamic State in Libya rest on persuading parliamentarians to end their divisions and create a unity government in Libya. But Jason Peck, an expert on Libya and the founder of EyeOnISIS.com, recommends an alternative approach to bypass the political stalemate in Libya. He says the U.S. can facilitate a coalition of Libyan militias.
In Libya, there are many such forces who oppose ISIS. These forces tend not to work well together, but they all oppose ISIS, and a coalition of convenience can be made, and the Libyan nation can be rebuilt by bringing together these main fighting forces to work together against ISIS.
Peck argues that airstrikes alone are not likely to defeat ISIS. He says a coalition of Libyan militia forces can be the ground troops needed to mop up and conquer territories held by ISIS. Peck says Such a coalition would need training and weapons before it could launch an attack to retake Sirte, aided by Western air power. PAC says the U.S. and Western powers should build up on the momentum of the latest gains against militant groups in Libya.
The cleansing of Benghazi and Ajdabiya of jihadist cells, both ISIS and Ansar Sharia, is a breakthrough. And the momentum of these gains need to be carried forward and hopefully lead to new militia coalitions that could launch an attack on Sirte.
But Michael O'Hanlon, a military expert at the Brookings Institution, says Islamic State is already entrenched in Libya. He says it's too strong for any of the local actors nearby to face by themselves.
Realistically, I think we'll have to start more modestly by trying to help certain groups that we believe we can work with to get stronger in certain parts of the country. But I think the beginning process has to be working with certain groups that can then pressure ISIS on the ground while we consider pressuring ISIS from the air.
But the Libyan ambassador to the UN, Ibrahim al-Dabashi, says such move could complicate the Libyan situation. Al-Dabashi says it should be remembered that these militias withdrew from Sirte as soon as they clashed with ISIS fighters. James Clapper, the director of National Intelligence, told a congressional committee lately, "We would like nothing better than to have a government in place in Libya whom we could work with and from whom we would gain consent for engaging militarily in Libya." Mohammed Al-Shinawi, VOA News, Washington.
Past the hour, you're listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. The UN Special Investigator on Torture finds lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender people are at particular risk of torture and ill treatment, especially in places of detention. Lisa Schlein reports from the UN Human Rights Council in Geneva, where the investigator has submitted his report.
UN Special Investigator Juan Mendez says there is a clear link between the criminalization of lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender relationships and the hate crimes, police abuse, violence, and stigma these groups face.
These categories of inmates are disproportionately subjected to torture and other ill treatment, both in penal and non-penal settings. There are at least 76 countries in the world that have laws criminalizing consensual same-sex relationships between adults, even in private.
Mendez says gender-based violence occurs in all regions of the world, in developing and developed countries, although he notes this form of violence diminishes in nations with laws recognizing the rights of LGBTI persons. He tells VOA prisons are not designed to deal with the specific needs of these people.
They are either sent to join the general population where they can be prey to predators, or they are isolated for their protection, quote-unquote, without their even asking to be protected.
Studies show women make up between 2 and 9% of most of the world's prisoners. Mendez says up to 80% are mothers, yet most jails typically are designed for men and have no specific services for women. Mendez says denial of safe abortion services to a woman whose life is endangered or who is a victim of rape or incest can also amount to torture or ill treatment. He says governments have an obligation to reform their laws in this respect. He also says nations have an obligation to protect women who are victims of domestic violence, saying the problem is more prevalent than most people realize. He notes an estimated 35% of women worldwide have experienced various kinds of domestic violence. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
In Malawi, farmers around the capital are using human urine on their crops instead of costly imported chemical fertilizers. It's the result of an innovative local initiative that is transforming the lives of both the farmers and city residents. Lamek Messina reports from Lilongwe, Malawi.
There is new business in the Area 25A neighborhood these days, selling human urine for use as a crop fertilizer. Every day, people carry buckets of the stuff to the market. 75-year-old Modesta Kamoto says she uses the money to pay for school fees and buy food, soap, and school uniform for her 10 orphaned grandchildren. She collects the urine every morning from plastic containers her family members use as urinals, and she sells it to Urine for Worth Project. Urine has been nature's fertilizer for millennia, though that's not a well-known fact nowadays in the age of chemical fertilizers. Malawian agriculturist Goodfellow Peely started Urine for Worth as a small family initiative 9 years ago. It has grown into a thriving business. The project was one of six finalists for the HIVO's Social Innovation Award in Amsterdam in 2014.
We buy 20-liter container at 1,000 Malawi kwacha, and the 5-liter container we buy at 300 Malawi kwacha. When we process that into fertilizer, we sell the same to farmers. 20 liters we sell 3,000 kwacha. The 5 liters we sell 1,000 kwacha.
He can buy up to 200 liters per day. Peely ages the urine in airtight containers for 7 days. The process kills germs and the smell, and it makes the liquid rich in nitrogen. He sometimes adds lemongrass to help with odor, but says no additives are actually needed. Farmers say the fertilizer is cheaper and more environmentally friendly than chemicals. Urine for Worth has now erected a urine harvesting plant at the main market in Area 25A with funding from two environmental NGOs. People are encouraged to relieve themselves there in special urinals. The project also has women selling composite manure they make mixing the urine with the animal waste. Enedi Jadza is a widow and leads a group of 20 women. She says her worries are gone and she's able to feed her family with what she earns. Despite their success, Peely says challenges abound.
The greatest challenge with this type of product, which is bio-nitrate fertilizer, is that many people don't like it. They think it's unhygienic to apply fertilizer made from human urine.
Seed companies and the Ministry of Agriculture have enlisted Urine for Worth to produce fertilizer for their demonstration fields, something Peely hopes will win over more farmers to the idea. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Lilongwe, Malawi.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. Stay tuned for Straight Talk Africa with Shaka Sali, coming up at 18:30 UTC. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Sidrak Franklin, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa, we'll discuss food and the rise of African cuisine with host Shaka Sali and his guests. Tune in to Straight Talk Africa next Wednesday at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
Hello, Africa. I'm James Butte, host of VOA's Daybreak Africa. VOA. When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you the news as it happens. Listen to Daybreak Africa Monday through Friday at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC. And our 5 minutes newscast come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.